This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It doesn't sound very romantic when couples discuss having to work on their relationships. But let's face it, a lot of couples need to work on how they handle conflict. That's where my guest, Dr. John Gottman, comes in. He spent the past 25 years observing how couples interact and analyzing why some relationships last and others fall apart. Gottman directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute and is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He also runs weekend workshops for couples, which he calls the Marriage Survival Kit. His books include Why Marriages Fail and Succeed and The Heart of Parenting, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. I asked Dr. Gottman what he's looking for when he observes how couples interact.
Well, actually, the only thing I really bring to the whole question is just one thing. And that, if I can tell you a story, when I was a beginning assistant professor, I was interested in the problem of kids who didn't have any friends. And I found that there was a psychologist who had developed a program to help kids make friends. And I called him up and I asked him for information about the program and would he send me the materials he had developed. And then I asked him, how did you develop these materials? And he said, well, I sat around with a couple of graduate students and we tried to imagine what it was like to be 4 years old and we figured out how to make friends. And I did some research after that, which took me about 10 years to find out how children really do make friends. Turned out that he was teaching children to do things like go over to other kids and say, hi, my name is Harold, can I play with you? And that turned out in the research I did later to be the perfect way to get rejected.
Yeah.
So, you know, what the only thing I bring to this whole thing is really trying to find out what it is that real couples do whose, you know, marriages are going well, who, you know, marriages are stable and satisfying, rather than trying to assume that I know. We do things like, you know, in Seattle we have 130 newlyweds we've been following for the past 8 years. And we also study couples who've been married a long time, two groups of couples in their 40s and one group of couple in their 60s, and try to see, you know, just what do these people actually do to make their marriages work.
Now, how do you study this?
A variety of ways. We really try to do it just about every way we can. I have an apartment laboratory in Seattle where couples live for 24 hours, and they don't have any instructions. They just come there in the morning with a bag of groceries, and they read the Sunday paper, and they eat together and watch television and work, do what they normally would do at home. We also have them
But you're running surveillance on them while they do this, right?
Right. There's four cameras pointed at them. Yeah. They wear these Holter monitors that measure electrocardiograms. And every time they urinate, we take a sample of the urine and get stress hormones out of the assays and take blood from them at the end and look at their immune system. But after about 45 minutes, people are really kind of behaving naturally. We actually know that they never totally behave naturally. They're a little nicer to each other when their camera's there than they would be at home. We've actually recorded them at home, and there's a lot more upset and nastiness that goes on for longer periods of time when they're home.
So if somebody says, dear, you know, I really hate it when you leave the dishes for me to do, then you're measuring the stress hormones, the blood pressure, heartbeat in
exactly
both of the members of the couple when this,
yeah,
conversation continues.
That's right. That's right. And then we show them their videotapes and ask them to tell us, hey, what were you thinking? What were you feeling? What do you think your partner was thinking and feeling? We interview them about these moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then we record their facial muscles and code exactly what emotional expressions are on their face, what's going on in the voice, what's going on in the body, what they're saying. So we actually have observers there coding people's behavior, categorizing every small behavior that they engage in. And then we interview them about the history of their relationship, how they met, how they think about their marriage, and, you know, various difficult times and how they get through difficult times. Try to get their philosophy and their, you know, own narratives about their marriage, very much like Studs Terkel would do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he sits with somebody in their attic and asks them, well, tell me about this doll, you know. In fact, we model a lot of our interviewing on Studs Terkel's methods.
When you're doing one of these marital interviews, does each member of the couple contradict the other in describing the marital history?
Happens sometimes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most of the time, they kind of complete each other's sentences, and they present really sort of a united front. But a lot of times, you'll find one person says, well, you know, this is a very difficult period for us, and the other person says, well, for you, it was a difficult period. For me, it was a great period. And so that person is really saying, you know, we're not really a unit. We're very different from each other. So it does happen a lot.
Do the couples watch the videotapes that you make of them?
Yes, they do. And we asked them to sort of narrate those videotapes and tell us what was going on in their minds. What were they thinking about? What were they feeling during those tapes? And we try to find out sort of what's different about what the observers see and what they perceive.
And what is often different?
Well, there's a very interesting phenomenon that happens in some marriages. You know, some of the time, the observers will say, well, this comment was really quite neutral. It wasn't even emotional, and yet the spouse will perceive it as very provocative. You know, so, like, for example, you know, a wife might say something like, you really aren't supposed to run the microwave oven with no food in it. And yet the partner will say, don't tell me what to do. You know, did you read the manual? You never read manuals. That's your problem. And some of the times, that wife might say something like, what's the matter with you? You're not supposed to run the microwave with no food in it. And the husband will say, oh, yeah, okay, thanks. I didn't know that. So you have this discrepancy between the way observers see it and the way the partners see it. That turns out to be a very critical dimension, because if you have a positive perspective, you see these sort of irritable kind of statements. You take the irritability as if the statement were in italics. You know, you say, oh, this must be important to my partner. If you've got that positive perspective, it turns out to predict an ability to repair conflict when it doesn't go well. And if you don't have that positive perspective, if you have more of a negative perspective, it predicts, in fact, that your ability to resolve conflict will deteriorate over time.
So people get deeper and deeper into those patterns?
Exactly, exactly.
When somebody sees this on the videotape, or when you point it out to them, how easy is it to repair?
It really isn't easy to change the positive or negative perspective. You have to do a whole bunch of things that really underlie these. And that's one of the things that we've discovered in the past couple of years, is that, you know, there's been a focus, very strong focus, on the resolution of conflict as being the way that couples really can get close and make their marriages work. And we've discovered that really that's wrong. That, in fact, the everyday interaction that couples have with one another, and there really are three things that form the basis of this positive perspective that makes them able to solve problems. One of them is just kind of knowing one another, knowing things about one another. And it really has to do with, well, we actually have a board game that couples play in our workshops, where we ask them things like, who is your spouse's least favorite relative? Or what side of the bed does your spouse prefer to sleep on? And a lot of people don't know things like that.
So what you're saying there is one of the really most important aspects of a successful relationship is paying attention to the person you're in the relationship with.
Exactly, and knowing things about them. So if you opened up the skull of some guys, you know, you'd find a lot of brain cells allocated to the relationship and the partner. And other guys, you know, you'd find, very few. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see this. So when we ask people how they met, you know, some guys are saying things like, oh, you know, it was, I remember the night we met at this dance and, you know, she was wearing a yellow dress and the band was playing As Time Goes By. And I thought it was just a slow song. I could ask her to dance. But then I found my feet were glued to the floor. My heart was beating fast. And then she came over, asked me to dance. And you ask another guy, how did you and your wife meet? And he'll say, Anna, how did we meet? Really, you know, it's right. Very, very clear differences between people. So that's the first step out of three for building this positive perspective.
What's the next one?
Well, the next one is really the fondness and admiration system. It's really how much affection there is and how much respect there is in this relationship. And some people really, spontaneously say things like, boy, you know, there's one thing really I really admire about Jane. You know, she's really got a lot of guts. I mean, she had this boss who was really domineering, and Jane just went in and told her what she thought, and boy, I would never do that. And, you know, and she's done this with our son too, and she's gone and, you know, confronted the teacher who was really giving him a hard time. And you know, some guys never say things like that. And we find that this fondness and admiration system is really critical in keeping romance going in the relationship.
And the third
is what I call the emotional bank account. It really doesn't have much to do with emotional events. It's these everyday sort of mundane events that happen between people who are in a close relationship. And, you know, it can be something like one person's brushing their teeth in the morning and is in a big hurry. And then the partner comes in and says, I just had a disturbing dream. And then that, you know, you can either turn toward your partner and say something like, I'm in a real big hurry, but what'd you dream? And then you get a sort of a rundown of the dream. And then later on, you think about it and then you talk about it at dinner. Or you can just say, well, you know, I'm in a big hurry. I really can't talk about this. It's not that turning away is necessarily hostile. It's just that over time, there's a characteristic either of turning toward or turning away. So couples who are heading for divorce, you know, 60 to 80% of the time, they're turning away from one another. And couples whose marriages are going very well, 60 to 80% of the time, they're turning toward one another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Gottman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, and he directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Gottman, and he directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. Okay, so to sum up here, you're saying good marriages, they're not about how you handle the big conflicts, more about day-to-day life, how you handle day-to-day life, how you handle your affection for each other, your reactions
exactly
to each other. Now, say someone has pointed out to you that you don't express fondness very clearly, even if you feel it, you're not verbally expressing it. Say that's just your character type. Is that something that you can really change in a way that's going to help your spouse feel more confident about your feelings?
One of the things that we work on that's sort of related to this is that, you know, we look at how people resolve problems. It turns out that, you know, when you select a relationship, when you select a person to be close to, you automatically are selecting a set of unresolvable perpetual problems that you'll never resolve. And that, you know, if you married somebody else or you got into a relationship with somebody else, you'd have a different set of perpetual problems you'll never resolve. And some couples sort of establish a dialogue with these problems. And actually, it turned out when we analyzed this that about 56% of all the problems that couples had were of this kind, where they had a dialogue with problems like he was not as affectionate as she would like, or, you know, maybe he was a loner and she was very gregarious, or, you know, he was very neat and she was, you know, really untidy. This is a problem that they'll have their whole lives together. And some couples kind of come to a peace with that. It's not that they're happy about it. They have a kind of dialogue with it. It's like it's a soccer ball between them that they kick around every now and then. And there's a lot of acceptance and understanding and humor and amusement about the problem, even though they're actually trying to change it all the time, make it a little better. And that the thing you described is very much like that. And the problem becomes when you get really a lot of pain around these problems. I'll give you an example of this. You know, in this case, you get kind of a gridlock situation. And one example was a husband who wanted to spend more time with his friends. And his wife was very upset about this because what the friends did was they went to topless bars and he flirted with women. And he couldn't understand why his wife was bothered by that. And this kept being a source of tremendous pain between the two of them. So one of the things that we need to do, and we try to do in our workshops and in the therapy, is to move these gridlock conflicts that cause a great deal of pain and suffering to dialogue with perpetual problems. In other words, the problem doesn't go away. It's never going to go away. But with marriages that are working well and with longer relationships, long-term relationships, people kind of learn to accept the differences between them and live with them, even though they're still trying to change them slightly and make them better over time.
You know, you're talking about the importance of talking about your differences in the relationship. But even the threshold at which you're able and willing to talk about a difference is a difference in the relationship.
Absolutely.
I mean, often one partner really likes to talk about the relationship and work on the relationship, and the other partner hates stuff like that.
That's right.
Hates yeah,
we even have a name for it. It's called the pursuer distancer pattern, and usually
that's what I call it. No,
you know, one person pursues the issue, and the other one tries to become distant from
it.
Yeah,
right.
And usually it's the woman who is the pursuer, and the male who's the distancer. That's usually the situation. Although it does vary a great deal. This is characteristic of most marriages. Although the problem gets accentuated when there is a lot of continued hostility in the marriage.
Well, when you're working with a couple and one person likes to talk about the relationship and the other person hates to talk about the relationship, what advice do you give the couple about how to deal with talking about the relationship?
Usually the one who wants to talk about the relationship wins. You know, it's sort of like a situation like the neater person usually wins in these conflicts about neatness. The person who has more concerns is usually the one who wins, because the important dimension is being able to respond emotionally to your partner and to have some kind of emotional connection. And what really becomes an issue is if, you know, the person who really wants to talk feels unresponded to and becomes kind of desperate in this attempt to really be understood and to really have a connection, an emotional connection with the partner. So usually the one who doesn't like to talk about it comes up a bit in, you know, in their willingness to talk about it.
Well, you make an interesting distinction between a complaint and a criticism, and the way complaints and criticisms are verbalized. What are the issues there?
Well, the difference is that when you complain, you're really talking about something you're upset about, and it's not really kind of a global blaming and attack on your partner's personality. So if I say to my wife something like, you know, I'm really upset that you talked about your day during dinner and you never asked me anything about my day, that would be a complaint. But if I then add, you know, what's wrong with you? I mean, what kind of a person would do something like that? Why do you treat me this way? Then it's going to make my partner really defensive. It's kind of like I'm saying, you know, there's something wrong with her character, mm-hmm. something wrong with her personality. And she's got to say, well, you know, I listen to you a lot of times, and sometimes you don't listen to me. And then it gets very defensive.
So what advice would you have about how to state a complaint without it escalating into criticism that leads to defensiveness and more anger?
Well, we have a thing that we teach couples to do, which we call soften startup. You know, the way they start up a complaint really matters. One of the things that's real important in this is sort of the way you say things and how you present things. Like, for example, I could, you know, let's say I've been feeling pretty distant from my wife. You know, I can say, you are so emotionally distant from me. You're emotionally unavailable, you know, and I'm fed up with it. Or I could say, you know, I've really been missing you lately. And, you know, last week when we were on the couch and we were kissing, how could we do more of that? You know, that I really miss that, you know, in our day. We're getting so stressed that we're not really doing that. So in a way, it really communicates the same thing, but one way of presenting the complaint is pretty flattering.
Yeah.
You know, it's really saying, you know, I want more of you. You know, I really like you. I really want more of you. And the other one's saying, there's something wrong with you. So they really look for, you know, a way of saying it that softens it, makes the partner less defensive.
You've worked with people who are violent, with couples in which one of the partners is abusive. Do you think people like that can change?
Well, you know, for the last 8 years, Neil Jacobson, my colleague, and I have been studying these violent marriages, and we have found that over time, in most couples, the physical violence declines significantly. Really does decline, and we found that in a number of these marriages, the physical violence will end. Unfortunately, in those cases, we've also found when we analyze our videotapes that when the physical violence declines, the emotional abuse increases. So if you look at both emotional abuse and physical abuse, we only found one couple out of 62 couples where over time both the emotional abuse and the physical abuse ended. So I'm pretty pessimistic about these things going away by themselves.
What qualifies as emotional abuse?
There are two forms of it that we discovered. One of them is really just humiliating the partner in public, doing things like forcing the partner to accept sexual practices that are repugnant to the partner, controlling the partner's life, and threatening to destroy property and pets. These are the dimensions of emotional abuse. There's a second form that is even more insidious that we call gaslighting, which comes from the movie Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman, Charles Boyer, where he's married to her and he's trying to convince her that she's insane. This sort of insidious kind of undermining of the woman's worldview is even more controlling and even more powerful than the standard forms of emotional abuse. And I think we saw it in the Steinberg-Nussbaum case, where, you know, Steinberg really completely controlled Nussbaum's consciousness about how to see the world. These men are often very charismatic for the women that they're involved with. And this gaslighting thing is very common of abusive men who are really jealous and really have this terror of being abandoned.
Dr. John Gottman directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Gottman, director of the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. He spent the past 25 years observing how couples interact and working with couples who are having difficulty dealing with conflicts. When we left off, we were talking about abusive relationships. I asked Dr. Gottman what he's learned about why some men abuse women in order to control them.
They really have a lot of trouble connecting with a woman. And I think really having intimate relationships in general. And in some ways, the conflict becomes the center of the way of connecting to the partner. It's, you know, it is the way. I mean, one of the things that's really very interesting about all of these violent couples is they don't have very much fun. I mean, they don't do stuff like go to the zoo, you know, or go to the circus on the weekends and, you know, have a lot of laughs and kid around or sit around and, you know, in a warm bathtub and, you know, and drink wine together. That a lot of times the way they meet, the way they sort of join each other is through the arguments and through the conflict. And for these guys, a lot of what they're doing is trying to work out a real major childhood trauma where they've been, you know, abandoned in the case of these guys who really fear abandonment and are very jealous, or they've been very controlled as children and really abused, and they've somehow decided, either consciously or unconsciously, that they're never going to be controlled again. So that's, you know, I don't know if that's a good answer to your question. It's not really that they're, I don't think they're really thinking out this. It's more sort of automatic, this control in a relationship.
So when you're working with a violent couple, are you likely to say to them, you'd be better off splitting up? This relationship is unlikely to be repaired.
Yes. Unfortunately, you can't really say that, because what that winds up doing is really alienating the woman and making her feel like she's nuts for staying with this guy. You know, and there's something wrong with her for continuing to be in this relationship. Part of what we've discovered is that what keeps women in these relationships is they love these guys, and they identify with their struggles, and they really sort of are on their side. And through this process of really sort of being on the side of these guys and loving them, they really have developed a dream about what this guy could become. And until they're ready to give up that dream, they're going to stay in that relationship. They're going to forgive the men for doing what they've done to them. Some of these women are suffering internal organ damage and broken bones and, you know, really very serious violence, and they're still staying in there. But there comes a point, and when we studied the women who really successfully divorced these guys, that the women give up the dream. A lot of times it takes a near-death experience in a violent episode to make a woman do that.
Do you feel optimistic that people are capable of change, and therefore that relationships that are having trouble are capable of being repaired?
Yes, I feel very optimistic. And I mean, in fact, you know, Terry, I think of myself as very much like the 15th century Portuguese map makers who were mapping the Atlantic Ocean for people like Christopher Columbus. You know, we scientists who study relationships are really like these map makers, where we're finding that there really are things we can learn about relationships, that there are, you know, we can develop some kind of a map. A marriage doesn't come with a manual, and babies don't come with a manual. So a lot of what I think is necessary is just education. People have to know things about what's going to happen to them when they, you know, when they first get married and then they become parents and they have a baby on their hands. You know, and 75% of all couples after the baby's born, 3 months after the baby's born, experience a precipitous drop in marital happiness that leads to divorce. Half of all the divorces occur in the first 7 years of marriage. Now, what is it that people can do to buffer themselves from this drop in marital satisfaction? And we know the answer now, particularly for guys. You know, the emotionally intelligent husband is a reality. And so it seems like men can learn about how to be in relationships. And the relationship can have this knowledge, and I think it can buffer marriages from this, the sort of natural shocks that happen, you know, as people try to have a relationship over time, a close relationship.
When do you think it's too late to save a marriage?
Well, I think it's too late to save a marriage when the fondness and admiration system is dead. You know, if it's just a glowing ember, we can fan it into a flame. But if it's gone, if people no longer have respect for one another, if there's no affection there, then I don't think there's much you can do.
You started studying relationships back in the 70s, right?
Correct, right.
So you've seen the results of the women's movement over the decades.
Yes.
Do you think the women's movement has changed the relationships that you've been studying?
Absolutely. I think it's the single major thing that's happened worldwide that has affected families everywhere. And I think it's the most important change that has taken place in families. And not that it's happening everywhere, you know, and there are some places really resistant to it. But in the United States, the loss of the breadwinner role as women have entered the workforce and not only have made some money, but also have had jobs that are meaningful, has been really very big. It's really affected men in particular. And men are casting around, you know, really looking everywhere for how to be in families, how to be a good husband, how to be a good father. I think men are lost.
Do you think that you're able to use the results of your work at home? I mean, can you apply what you know scientifically to your own marriage?
I try. And my wife tries. So, yeah, we find that, you know, once we've learned something and, you know, it seems to work and make sense, that we can really use it with one another. And it's very effective. Some of the times, you know, I wish the information had been available years before. You know, we could have saved ourselves a lot of pain. But I think, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do in doing this research is to find ways of changing people, you know, helping people change their relationships that really are not that hard to do. And, you know, I think a lot of the mistake that we've made as marital therapists or people who have designed marital therapies is we've kind of try to make people in general into psychologists. We've tried to convert them into psychologists. And really what we should do is just the opposite. Find out how everyday, you know, relationships work, how people are able to make those work, and really build a psychology from that, from learning how people manage their relationships. Because there are real masters out there at managing relationships. And there's a magic in the way they do it. You know, if you know about these little moments in which you can turn toward one another or turn away, then you kind of become aware of them and you do it, and it actually works. All of this stuff really works.
John Gottman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Dr. John Gottman directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. His books include Why Marriages Fail and Succeed and The Heart of Parenting, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child.